This episode brought to you by Beta Brand, the San Francisco-based source for crowdfunded clothing. You can visit in person the next time you're in San Francisco, or stop by anytime online to shop bestsellers like dress pant yoga pants and now yoga jeans. And when you do, use the code SPIRIT20 to save 20% off anything on the site. Spirit is 608, episode 122. Spirit of 608 podcast. I'm your host, Lorraine Sanders. Keep listening for stories, tips, and advice from women at the forefront of fashion, entrepreneurship, sustainability, and tech. I call it best, and it's the future. Hey, hey, and welcome to today's episode of the Spirit of 608 podcast. Welcome back. If you have listened to the show before, welcome, welcome. If you have not, so glad that you chose to open up your podcast app or wherever it is that you listen to podcasts and check us out today. I got a great episode for you coming up. Something I've been wanting to talk about on the show for a really long time, and it's digital marketing. It's something that I increasingly feel should be tied, intimately tied, to your PR strategy, your public relations strategy, your earned media strategy. So in industry parlance, if you will, people will refer to getting covered in the media as earned because it didn't cost you money in theory, even though, you know, frequently you are paying for somebody to help you do your PR outreach in many cases. But on the digital marketing side, people refer to that as sponsored or paid media because, as you would with a Facebook ad or any of these other forms of advertising that you can use today, advertising on Google, paying to be in those little boxes that show up at the bottom of other articles and say you might also like, that kind of stuff, that's all paid. And as time marches on, this stuff gets increasingly complicated, I think, and sophisticated is probably the better word. There have never been more ways for you to get the word out about your brand, but while that is happening, there have never been more questions about the best way to get the word out about your brand, especially if you're a small independent brand and you don't have a gigantic agency working on your side to execute and secure either earned or paid media. So today we are having an expert in the digital marketing arena come on the show and talk to us about what he knows and what he thinks we should be doing as small businesses, small brands, fast brands, thinking about digital marketing strategy in the weeks and months to come. Now, you may have noticed that I just said he, and I did, because our guest today is a guy, Jay Stanfill. He is the founder of Blackbird PPC, a digital marketing agency based in San Francisco. He has worked with a number of extremely festive brands, including Kuyana, Sephora, The Real Real. The list goes on. He not only knows digital marketing inside and out, but he also knows the kinds of businesses that many of you are in the midst of building. He's also an entrepreneur in his own right. He left the agency world and started his own company in 2016. So he understands not only the digital marketing piece of this whole conversation, but also what it's like to be an entrepreneur. So I got a real kick out of talking to him. I think you're going to get a kick out of hearing what he has to say. Up ahead in the conversation, another thing I think you're going to get a kick out of. You know what I'm doing. I'm going to talk about Beta Brand, our fabulous episode and show sponsor that you can visit anytime in San Francisco or online at betabrand.com. That's www.betabrand.com. And the thing that is calling me this week, I landed on the site and I'm like, oh my God. So dresses, people. We're getting into the holiday season, right? It's like November and the rest of the year is coming at us like a freight train. All of a sudden, there are all of these reasons that you've got to step it up a notch, dress up. Sometimes you got to go day to night without coming home to change. That happens pretty frequently. And frankly, all of that stresses me out. Like, I do not need the extra stress in my life to try to figure out what I'm going to wear all the time, even though, yes, I do stress about what I'm going to wear all the time. And the modern lace dress from Beta Brand helps to solve that problem. It's an awesome LBD. It's a little black dress made of modal silk jersey. So super comfortable. It's made to be very like easy to move in, easy to wear, comfy all day, but it's got this beautiful laser cut mesh top to it and 3/4 length sleeves. So you can throw a jacket on over it for work during the day, but take it off at night. It's like, bam, cocktail. There you go. It's kind of one of those awesome crossover pieces. It has pockets and it's machine washable, which is insane because most dresses that you would ever want to wear to anything involving a cocktail are not machine washable. They're just not. So this is a great piece. It's a relatively affordable $115 at this point on the site, although the price does go up as time goes on, but you can save 20% with the code SPIRIT20 on this dress or anything on the site. Last but not least, I also love it because it was designed by Beta Brand's senior women's wear designer, Bethany Moulinars, and she graduated from the Academy of Art, which I used to teach fashion journalism at the Academy of Art. So I have a soft spot in my heart for the school and the program. It was cool to see that she was the woman behind this dress. Check it out. You'll find it at betabrand.com. Stick around after the conversation with Jay. I'll be giving a shout out to one very special Press Dope member after the show. That's coming up. Now on to everything you need to know to get started with digital marketing as a fest brand with Jay Stanfill of Blackbird PPC. Jay, welcome to the Spirit of 608 podcast.
Thank you for having me, Lauren.
Yeah. So I'm excited to get you on the show. This is a different kind of conversation than we usually have. And I'm really excited about it because I really can't tell you how many people in the Spirit of 608 audience have been asking me for months for more information about digital marketing and what they need to be doing as they are in their first, you know, 1, 2, 3 years of business and trying to grow. Obviously, digital marketing is nothing new, but I think it's becoming, you know, more and more and more important for all of these startup brands. So I know this is going to be a cool conversation. I'm glad to have you here.
Well, I certainly hope so. We'll try our best.
Yeah, we will. So can you start us off by telling us where you are in the world and also what your company is called and what it does?
Right. My name is Jay Stanfill. I'm based in San Francisco. And I'm a digital marketer, concentrated in paid media. Been doing it for about 10 years now, mainly on the agency side. And just about a year and a half ago, I started this company called Blackbird PPC. And what that is a smaller personalized agency where we run Facebook, Google AdWords, display, things like that. So we pretty much take care of all your paid media, and we predominantly work with startups, a fair amount of them being in the fashion space.
All right, cool. And so listeners know, I mean, it's kind of obvious we don't have a ton of guys on the show. In fact, I think Jay is probably maybe like the fourth guy other than my 7-year-old son to have his voice on the show. And I wanted to mention one of the reasons that I really wanted to have you out of all the digital marketers that there are out in the world. And that's because you work with a lot of brands that fall under this umbrella that I call FEST. So I call the intersection of fashion, entrepreneurship, sustainability, and tech. FEST, right. It's kind of my play on STEM. And you've worked with, what, Kiana, The Real Real, Sephora. So a lot of brands that are going to be ultra relevant to people who listen to the Spirit of 608. Is there something you enjoy about that category of company or that has led you to have a chance to work with brands like that?
Oh, certainly. Well, so I think a big part of it is just location alone. A lot of the brands that you're talking about are based in the Bay Area. That is a big part of it. But more than that, there's a lot of different, with every type of company, the way that you approach digital marketing is going to be a little bit different. If we're talking about these more fashion, e-commerce, retailer type companies, there's a lot of shared problems and also shared solutions. And because of that, it's pretty easy to start specializing, and it's pretty fun for the advertiser just because compared to a lot of other type of companies, You have a lot more data to work with. And on one hand, that could make it overwhelming and confusing, but that also gives you a lot of ammunition to make your optimizations and improve your program. So that's one of the reasons why, personally, I really like it.
Yeah, and I also like the fact that, you know, you said you were on the agency side, but you're also now, you're an entrepreneur in your own right. So I imagine that you can understand the position people building an early stage business are in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And I feel at this point, I'm much better at being an agency than I am at being an entrepreneur. I'm still, you know, I'm very much in the process of learning. And, you know, the way I feel, it's as if you're in a dark room and every now and then you hit a wall, and in your mind, you're like, oh, that's where that wall is. And if you just keep on wandering enough, you'll eventually know how the room is set up. So I think it's been an absolute blast. But like navigating the early stages of tax strategy and branding and things like that has just been a thrill. I get a lot of kick from it.
Yeah, like so fun. Navigating tax strategy. Yeah. You know, I feel like if you're an entrepreneur and you don't feel like you're walking around in a dark room running into things, there's probably something a little wrong with everything. So did you always think you would end up being a digital marketer, which is a ridiculous question to ask, I know, because that didn't exist.
As a 5-year-old?
Yeah, exactly. But right. I mean, but seriously, what did you think you were going to do when you grew up?
Well, so digital marketing really even wasn't an industry when I was growing up. And I mean, not in its modern capacity, certainly. There was ways to put advertisers on the web, but it wasn't that big. Certainly wasn't glamorous. And it wasn't part of like the national consciousness in any way. I thought, you know, and what I studied for in college is I thought I was going to go in academia. In fact, my first job out of college was living in the forest studying monkeys, which is, you know, a little bit of a unique experience. I have a lot of jungle stories if we have the time. But no, one thing that's nice about digital advertising is that it's this huge industry. It's growing like in between 8% and 12% YOY for the last 10 years. It's becoming more complicated in some ways and becoming more accessible in others. And back when I started, no one was really that good at it. It was a little bit of the wild, wild west. So there was a lot of opportunity to just jump in and try to take ownership over it. I don't know how many industries that you work 2 to 3 years and really be considered like an expert. I mean, certainly, you know, compare that to something like banking or consulting. That's, you know, that just doesn't happen. There's something cool about how free it is.
Okay, I've got to ask you, what jungle?
Oh, yeah, the jungle. I was in the Guanacaste province in Costa Rica. It's a tropical dry rainforest. Been bitten by wasps and ants. I have like really very finite descriptions of all the different types of wasps I've been bitten by. It was pretty crazy. Saw a lot of really big boa constrictors and panther. It was a life experience. Ultimately, the people who do really well with that are the people who just want to hike around all day in the jungle. And I'm not really that guy. I'm more of I like to go to nice dinners and, you know, work on my computer and look at numbers and things like that. So, yeah, it's a hard life, but I have a lot of respect for the people who do choose to go down that evolutionary biology field research route.
So now you're in the urban jungle and you're doing this and you are working with a lot of companies in the e-commerce space. When it comes to fashion or style-driven companies in particular, is there anything that you're seeing right now that's really exciting about the space? And I'll say that I asked this kind of within the wings in my mind. I've been hearing people say recently that they think it's getting harder and harder and harder to be competitive from a digital marketing standpoint just because of how sophisticated all of these marketing efforts are getting, right? So I'm wondering if you see something out there that is exciting or you think would, you know, help people listening feel optimistic about the future and their prospects when it comes to this stuff.
Let me do the pessimistic first, and then I'll do the optimistic. Okay, so like the three things about why I would be pessimistic, it's like number one, it's like the Amazon effect. You know, Amazon just buys everything and they push CPCs up and they just is this dark horse that's like absolutely changing consumer behavior. So that's like number one. Number two is like, yeah, you're right. People are getting more serious about digital marketing and they have a lot better strategies now. You know, I would say 10 years ago, I would crack open an account and just look at this, you know, this travesty. just wasted money and, you know, just no focus, things like that. And now accounts are getting better as people get a little more savvy with it. And probably the last one is a lot of the ways that you buy ads used to be really pretty complicated, pretty Byzantine. Now there's now a little bit more simple solutions that actually make the barrier to entry a little bit easier. So on one hand, that does mean that there's more competitors in the market doing a better job. But that also means for your listeners that, you know, actually you could test with a very pretty like light barrier to entry.
All right. That's good. Well, that's good news. So I would love to know, before we get into sort of the information heavy section of the interview, the training that we're going to be bringing people, do you think that there are any trends out there that we should be aware of? Anything that's shifting or changing that we need to know about right now in this sort of latter part of 2017?
So specifically for Q4 2017, I would just say what I'm seeing is pretty high CPCs coming in from both Google and Facebook. Not atypical, just going into holiday season. Seeing a continued trend of all shopping products owning a lot more volume. So shopping is going to be that feed-based. When you search for, like, let's say, leather shoes, you're going to see leather shoes on the top of the page. That's the shopping side of things. That's becoming really, really big and has grown over the course of the last 5 years. And then other than that, well, I want to say that the Amazon effect is pretty real. There's a lot of, when you see a lot of search queries, sometimes you see them changing just because people are finding shopping on Pinterest, they're shopping on Instagram, things like that. So there's a bit of a more like diverse marketplace than I think there was 4 years ago.
Okay. And just to make sure everybody listening understands what you're saying. So CPC, cost per click, you're talking about how much everybody has to pay when their ad is clicked on. And then when you say the shopping thing at the top, you're talking about in Google, if I search for leather shoes and all of the stuff that comes up at the top of that page, not anything that we've seen on Facebook, right?
Definitely. Now Facebook does have an equivalent product, and these two things are pretty important for like all fashion e-commerce brands. And what they're ads that are dynamically generated by the back-end product feed of your own inventory. And it's probably the most important thing within paid media if you're a fashion e-com brand. So when I talk about shopping or when I talk about the feed, it really just means like these dynamically generated ads that are based on your own company information.
Okay. Yeah. So say I am an early stage fashion brand, or I'm selling something that has a style component, you know, maybe it's accessories or something or shoes. And I come to you and I'm like, I want to get into digital marketing. I know I need to do it, but I've done nothing. Can you walk me through a couple of things that you would want every brand to have done before they put even a single dollar into a digital marketing campaign?
Yeah, I think you got it, hitting on a point that I see a lot. It's that a little bit of like apprehension of, hey, I know I should be doing this, but I'm not, and I don't really know how to start in terms of like getting into the paid media space. And I think that's pretty common because like if you ever open up any of these channels and you look at the platform, I think it looks pretty overwhelming. There's, you know, there's like a ton of different options. And if you click the wrong option, you could potentially lose a ton of money. I totally respect that when you look at it like that, it's why that a little bit of nervousness comes out. But you're right. There's a lot of ways to set yourself up for success long before you even start spending some any real money in terms of paid user acquisition. I would say like the most important one is like is usually what a lot of fashion brands do pretty well. And that's just like, do you have a website that looks good, that clearly shows your products, that has like a distinctive feel? Now, the very worst thing you could do is push traffic to a website that just looks cheap. And that's like a little bit of a hard thing to quantify, but it's like when you see it, you know.
Well, we deal with that all the time. And I mean, a lot of what I talk to people about is how to set yourself up for success with earned media. And it's a similar issue. I will have people frequently say to me that they think they've got a press problem. And it turns out that what's really happening is a branding problem, you know, whether it's an out of date looking website or inconsistency across their sort of digital touch points that people, you know, arrive on when they start looking into the brand. And it makes a lot of sense to me that it's similar with digital marketing because you can push all the traffic in the world to a website. But if people don't like what they see when they get there, then they're not going to do anything going forward.
Right. And I think like that this point of like, what does a professional website look like versus that cheap looking website? It's like, we all know it when we see it. And there's, it really, it's not one thing. It's a lot of little things that just comes down to web design and what type of feel you want to have your website to give your consumer.
Yeah. And I mean, is there anything, this is pretty like vague question, but is there anything about the setup of a website that could affect how you're able to interact with something like the Facebook advertising platform or Google? I mean, do you need to have something that's contemporary enough so it can even take advantage of all the functionality that's available to you, or is that not really a thing?
In terms of functionality, the main thing you're going to want is to have, I would imagine like most of your listeners, Lorraine, have used like some sort of like Shopify or Magento. That has like the native integration to things like your inventory product feed, things like that. Now that's the most important thing to have. But I would also say like other than in general, high quality images, distinct brand sense, and you also need to start having some landing pages. So sometimes just sending people to your homepage is okay. But if you are showing an ad of a very specific bag, it probably behooves you to push that to a landing page that just shows that product. So like a big part of like getting started is just making sure you have those creative assets. Like, so do you have the ads and do you have the landing page to push it to, things like that.
And that I imagine would require some strategic thinking around, okay, what are we going to choose as the most important products to send people to or pages? And why are we doing that? And is that something that digital marketers like you frequently work with clients to determine, that piece of the strategy and what's going to be most effective? Or do most brands come to you with that already in mind?
I think it's always going to be a collaborative effort. It's hard for like an agency to really know the business as well as the actual business itself. But generally what I like to do is think about it as terms of like a timeline of user interaction. So oftentimes what happens is there's going to be a couple of staples products that a brand's really well known for, and that is more of an entry level product. And then once they go and buy that in terms of that primary purchase, after that, they kind of branch out within different products from there. So oftentimes what I like to do is go for like the best hits, the classics in that prospecting campaign, just to try to get people in and engaging. And then once they've bought, we could create campaigns that segment those guys out. And then we could give them different ads to really try to go for like that upsell on that next product, things like that.
So if somebody has not done a lot of digital marketing, is it fair to say you would advise them to pick an entry-level product, something that is maybe not the highest-end product that they have, but something that's more accessible, and to start experimenting around that, and then later maybe push the more specialized, unique things that they carry?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, most brands are going to have a number, maybe like a handful of different products that make up the majority of their sales. I'd say that's relatively typical. And then they have like a really long tail. So I would definitely start with like that first little bit and then kind of branch out from there. Half of the benefit of like early stage paid advertising is actually running tests though. So I think it's totally worth it to, if maybe you don't know how consumers are going to interact with your different products. Well, you know, paid advertising is actually a pretty good way to test that. You could send two different ads with two different products on it, and then you could measure the results of how people, if they like it or they don't like it. And same with your landing page, right? You could have them send to different formats and different structures. And by driving these people to your website, you actually are running an A/B test about product development on both the website and your actual whatever brands you think you should push.
Okay. So say you have in mind kind of what you think you want to start trying out in terms of the products, and you've done like some of the thinking around what your kind of early funnel is going to be. And you've talked about these free and foundational tools that people can use. I mean, what would you recommend setting up in advance before creating the campaign?
Yes. So this actually came from, I was talking at this, what it was a class only for startups. And like these guys had budgets of $200, you know, something like that, you know, where you really couldn't do much with it, but really trying to maximize that $200. And so the first thing you're going to do is just get everything you can that is for free. So I think the most important thing, and I see this actually like pretty commonly incorrectly set up, is just your Google Analytics. So Google Analytics is going to be like just like, I would say most, almost every website does use it to some capacity, but it's very common to have errors in it. If taking a little bit of time to make sure that you have the correct segmentation and you're tracking the goals that you're interested in, will pay a lot of dividends down the road. So I would say that would be the number one thing to do.
And how would I figure out if my goals are set up correctly? I mean, like, say I'm really coming to this with little information. Yeah. Where would I go to figure that out? Or do I need to hire somebody? Or do you have any thoughts, suggestions for that?
Well, so it depends on like how complicated like your traffic going to your website is. Usually it's pretty simple. It means that you have to, of the traffic that you currently have going to your website, you need to put some parameters on the URLs. Not too hard. Most people, they get most of their traffic via organic, and that auto reads itself. If you wanted to look at the goals, you would just go to the admin tab in the bottom left and then open that up and then slide over to the right. You're going to see a thing called goals, and then you could set up whatever goals you want. And from that, it could be as complicated as I want someone who has spent at least 4 minutes on this page and then moved to this other page and completed this action, like some really pretty specific paths. Or you could just say something like anyone who's ever bought anything, and you can make that a goal. So that would be the most common thing. Just make sure that when someone, like at the very minimum, when has someone gone to your website and purchased something? You need to be able to know that via GA.
All right. So we have Google Analytics set up and our goals are okay. They're intact. Right. What else can we do?
So I think a lot of things that I adore this, tell everyone, there's a lot of free tools within both Google and in Facebook that are used to understand your audience better. So let's say your company been running for a year and a half to 2 years, you know, you're maybe not doing very much outreach, maybe a little bit of PR, things like that, no paid media. You still have a list of emails of all the people who've converted from you in the past. What you could do is go into Facebook and upload that into their channels. And what Facebook is going to do is pretty much crunch the numbers and then see how you index compared to the rest of Facebook. Could be pretty interesting. I have an example I like to tell where I was comparing two different sets of emails. One of them was, and this is an outdoor company, so they do like tents and hiking shoes and like hunting paraphernalia, things like that. And we took two lists of people. One of them were the really high average order value email list, and the other one was just general purchasers. And when we put them through the machine and they spit out all this different information about the two lists. And what we cared about is in which ways were the lists different from each other. Well, a lot of the ways are exactly the same. You know, you would expect these lists to be similar, but we actually did note some pretty important differences. Namely, in terms of occupations, our high AOV set had indexed way higher in terms of being a veteran and being in the military and being a cop. And the reason why that is because one of the products that this company sold was ammunition. And so the people who were going to the firing ranges were buying ammunition consistently, which made their average order values really, really high compared to everything else. So then we just never really put the two to two together. So then we were able to create specialized campaigns that were really just going for, you know, this one segment of people who do go to the firing range and spend a lot of money by buying ammunition.
So you're able to pull this into, and is this what's called the Facebook Audience Insights?
That is what it is.
Okay. So you're able to pull your list in, and basically you're using Facebook to analyze these email addresses based on what they already know from their data, and they're able to tell you things about people that shop with you that you wouldn't have already known about them.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of it's going to be like exactly what you think, right? Something like, oh, it's 28 to 34 women who are a little bit more affluent. That's like a pretty typical demo for a lot of what I imagine your customer base would be. But then there might be little things that surprise you. And so the little surprising things I think are really useful.
Okay. So when it comes to doing that, about how big of a list do you need to have for that to be returning meaningful information to you?
Yeah. That's the tricky part, honestly. So it really depends on the list itself, hypothetically, let's say you have a group of consumers that just are not on Facebook, then you're going to need a very large list. I generally use like 5,000 to get something meaningful, but you can upload any amount. It just will be thinner results.
Okay. So it's not like there's a low threshold number. Like if you only have 200 people, the Facebook won't run the analysis. It's like, you just might not get as great.
Yeah, there is a lower threshold that they just won't show. It's relatively low though. Generally what the default recommendation is around like over 1,000, but I have used less than that. And then sometimes you just won't get any data.
All right. Yeah. So that's a great piece of advice. If you do have a list that's large enough, upload it and see what it can tell you so that you can further refine the campaigns that you're planning.
Right.
What's next?
And Google has one of those too.
Oh, okay. What's that called?
Yeah. You pretty much just go into Google. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's like called anything specifically, but it's pretty much called custom audiences. You go into Google, you upload emails, and then they'll show you information about them. Not quite as robust as Facebook, but still meaningful. They'll show you like what type of correlations to the type of industries that you could target separately. It's kind of the same thing, but also free and really good.
Now, you were talking about both of these in the context of purchases. Can I do this with my email list if it's just something I've grown by using, say, a lead magnet on my site, and they aren't people that have actually bought from me?
Certainly. Certainly can. Or like, I think another one would be good is like, hey, add to cart. These are the people who added to your cart but didn't actually purchase. I think that's a pretty good comparison. Like, here are the people who visited. Here's the people who added to cart. And here's the people who purchased. And then you could run all of them. And if you have enough data on all three of them, you could say, what are the differences between the people as they go through the funnel? Might be able to identify something when it comes down to. Like something also with that AOV analysis. There was also the high AOV guys skewed significantly higher in terms of household income, as you maybe would imagine.
No, that makes sense. Okay, so what next?
So I think there's like a lot of work that could be done within like the SEO space that you could do even before you start doing paid media. And what I mean by that is there's a lot of tools that will allow you to see what type of keywords are related to the type of keywords that your products are closely associated with. So if you go to Google and go into keyword research, and this is just a free tool that Google has, you could actually insert your website and then it will dynamically create lists of keywords that could be related. Now, some of them will be like just too aggressive, but also some will be like, oh, you know what? That's actually a little bit more, that's a better description than I'm currently using. And then what you could do is apply that on your website, get a little bit better SEO. I think for a lot of smaller fashion companies, the challenge is to really identify like what actual product combination is going to be what you try to go for, because it's going to be very difficult to go for things like bags. That's almost like too hard to break into. But like, what's that really specific term that your brand has close association and affinity for? Trying to find that is using these tools makes it a lot easier.
So say I go and I use this tool and I find some keywords that it returns or keyword phrases that it returns back to me. And I'm like, oh yeah, that'll totally work. I like those. That's a fit. Where do I put those? Is that like something that I would change in my product description or the name of my images or the meta description or what?
Literally yes to all three of those.
Okay.
Yeah, no, exactly. So meta descriptions, product descriptions, label your high definition ads with those descriptions. And even just like from like a header, right? A header perspective, you could say like, oh, you know what? I really want to make my big high, my pages really try to be skewed towards these terms that are going to be a little bit less competitive in the overall marketplace, but also have really good affinity with your own brand. And I think just looking at these lists will help you do that. Another thing you could do is, I think that's like a similar problem, is let's say you have a shirt and you named it Very Grease Shirt. Some like really specific fancy name for a color, which is great, but probably will not give you as many results if you just named it a green shirt. Actually, the way that you name products could really change how your products get shown. Now, on one hand, being too specific will not give you very much scale, but being very specific might get you better quality. So it's a little bit of a high wire act in trying to figure out exactly what to do with that. But looking at the keywords should be able to help you make those decisions.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I do know a fair number of brands that I work with love to name their products with really artistic referential names that are really cool. But I mean, there's probably, depending on how your website is set up, an opportunity to have that fun name somewhere, but put the basic description stuff in the right place, right? I mean, I guess you have to just kind of figure out how your site works and where, I guess if I was trying to figure out what the search engines are going to care about most when they're looking at my site and a product description, is that standardized or is there somewhere I would go to figure that out?
To see what the search engines will care about the most?
Well, I mean, like say I'm setting up my product page, right? And you've got somewhere that's the title and then you've got the description and then there's probably a place where you could put that funky name on that page, but it wouldn't necessarily be showing up to the search engine like the title. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, there's definitely things where you could have aspects of your page not crawled or like create competitive pages where one of them has the crazy name, one has the real name. Generally, that's frowned upon a little bit just because it splits your domain authority. But you totally can in like some of the actual like keyword components of a page. I mean, let's say your color is like tungsten glow or, something like that. And you could put it there. It's just a question of, is that going to take away from orange or something like that? So in some ways, if you feel that the brand, like by naming it that, there's like a certain brand uplift that in general that you get, I would say still do it. Just know that from a SEO optimization perspective, and also this is true of just like product feeds and backend data, it's just going to have a little bit of a harder time.
Okay, that's fair enough. I think it's like, know the rules before you break them.
Right. Well, it's like in naming a company, for example, sometimes you can name a company that's like very close to common searches. That makes it really difficult for that company to excel in SEO. It's like having a distinctive brand name is important. And then maybe having non-distinctive product names is also good too.
Okay, great. So say we've done some work around SEO. And I imagine as part of this too, I know one thing that you've talked about in the past that I don't think we should spend too much time on just because it's like a whole another conversation, but is this whole content marketing thing. So like you could create a lot of SEO, I would say oomph, by generating blog posts and using those keywords and doing all that kind of stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. And I was reading an article not too long ago about Away Luggage. Do you know those guys?
Yeah. And in fact, I think you mentioned them to me as an example of a company that had done some interesting digital marketing stuff.
They went for just a lot of content marketing and then used the articles with affiliates, and they generated a lot of press. And generating a lot of press, had a lot of backlinks into their website, which improved their SEO. You get this whole type of positive momentum going. And it's funny because like a traditional digital marketing program, it's like, okay, I invested this many dollars and I got this much in return. Whereas I think it's a little bit trickier to evaluate the return on a strategy when that's really centered around more of that just like earned media component. It's a little bit harder to just like very clearly see the X's and O's of it. But there's definitely been a lot of examples of success around that. So, and there's also the Taboolas and Outrange, which are native advertising channels that specifically are to push to blogs. Think of this New York City founder is disrupting a $3 million industry, something like that. Or this hoodie has a 4-month waiting period, those type of ads.
Yes. Too. The American Giant ads are like so intriguing. And well, tell me about, okay, so on the subject of Taboola and Outbrain and those tools, if I'm looking at doing something like that, I imagine like there's no one answer to this, but it's my impression is, as somebody who's never tried any of this because I don't do any paid marketing, but is that getting into something like Taboola or Outbrain is going to cost me more than just doing some Facebook ads? Is it typically more expensive? Do you need to put more into it for a longer period of time? Or is that, what's the deal with that?
Generally, you just do not see as good results, like just like historically speaking. And also the targeting on Taboola and Outbrain are just not as robust of what you see in Facebook. So that really cuts away from the efficacy. Now, last I heard, Outbrain was actually changing the way that they're allowing targeting, that you could get a little bit more specific. So maybe the jury is still out there. But I would say that Facebook for many reasons is the easiest way to jump into that type of thing. You have a lot more control. You could very easily just tie it into your organic posts that you're already doing. things like that. So,
okay. All right. So let's talk about, so one of the things that we're going to get into is determining the value of a click.
Oh yeah. Right.
And that's pretty basic, but can you talk to me a little bit about how somebody can think about that so they know what they should be willing to spend to get that, whatever that conversion is, whether it's somebody just clicking through or the ultimate goal that they're going for from that click.
Yeah. I always like really think about the value of the click as like the starting point in a program, but it's, I think it's also like a deceptively tricky concept. So like hypothetically, let's say 1 in 10 people go to your site. One of them is going to buy your shirt that costs $100, right? So you could say, well, the value of someone clicking my ad is $10 because that's what it breaks out to. For whatever targeting I'm doing, I get $10 per click. So I'd be willing to spend, you know, maybe $5 a click. I get $5 back every time I do that, something like that. I think that's the very first step. But then you start going into, well, but actually, the people who buy a shirt, maybe 3 months later, will come by and buy another shirt. So actually, maybe the revenue per click is a little bit higher for that when you start baking in like lifetime value. And then you could even get a little bit more complicated and say like, well, okay, that's true. But in between their first purchase and their second purchase, they actually consumed a couple more media. So we need to actually increase the cost of the click, things like that. So I think on the very first level, what you should just do is like of the people who visit your site, how many times does that actually turn into revenue? And then understand that by which targeting are those numbers correlated? And then from there, you can start getting a little bit more complicated.
All right. So one thing that came to mind as you were saying that is how long should I be willing to invest in a campaign before I'm going to be able to be taking away some meaningful information from it? I mean, I've heard of a lot of people, just because they're very budget conscious, only running something for like 2 weeks. What's your bias there? Do you think you need to go a lot longer than that? Do you have any kind of ballpark time frame in mind that you would advise somebody to think about when they're going to start out?
Yeah. And so it's not necessarily a money thing. It's not necessarily a time thing. It's a click thing. How many clicks do you need to get before you could say if it, something's profitable or just terrible or something like that? And it's tricky. It's really tricky. For Facebook, I've done as low as, you know, maybe $2,000. And that's pretty small. And that's like with like a conservative targeting with only the, one of the tricky things about all the different channels is there's a million different options, right? And you could get completely lost in it. But there's of those options, there's like a couple really solid bets that if you just start with those, generally you do pretty well. So like for Facebook, it would be use lookalike targeting. 1% in the US, Facebook desktop. And I know I just threw a lot of stuff at you, but I wanted that to be recorded because that's like the very highest profitable Facebook targeting that there is. And I would do that. I would put a very conservative daily spend cap on it. And I would go with my best couple of ads that I think are going to work and then try to just see how it works out.
So when you say lookalike audience, explain what that is.
Right. So this is historically, if you look at the trajectory of Facebook as a company, if you guys remember, it really bombed after its IPO. Advertisers were not making any money on it except for app gaming. So app gaming just like ruled everything and everything else just didn't do very well, which was a little bit of a surprise because with Facebook, we have all this information about the user. You know, the assumption was that's going to translate into like very specific targeting that would work well. But it didn't happen like that until Facebook made these targeting units called lookalikes. And pretty much what they do is you upload your list just like we did for the audience insight report. And then Facebook is going to create a targeting bucket of people who look like the people on your list. So pretty much anyone who ever bought your hat, Facebook's going to say these are the people who most look like these hat buyers. And because they have all this data, and because they have computers and AI and machine learning, they're actually really good at predicting this. So this generally has been the most incremental of all targeting and usually the most profitable as well. I 100% recommend starting here if you have enough emails to make it work.
Okay. And so that's why I'm seeing things in my newsfeed all the time that I've never heard of, but I'm like, wow, that's the coolest product ever because they have somebody. I mean, I'm always getting sucked in by these like weird hair tools and stuff that purport to make your life so much better. Yeah. Okay, so I wanted to ask you.
I click around so many like fashion ads. I get a ton of fashion ads for women too. So
you're probably getting like the funniest stuff. So let me ask you this, because I know that we're kind of coming up on the end of the time that we have to talk about this stuff. And I wanted to make sure that you touched briefly on this idea of remarketing, which seems like a good thing to hit on after we've talked about lookalike. Can you tell us what we would need to do to make that possible for our brand? There's a lot of people that I've talked to who find out, say, 6 months into building their brand that they really wish that they had put the Facebook pixel on their website, and now they don't have the data. So can you kind of give us a little bit of background on that?
Yeah, it's just one of those things that as you're setting up, before you even do it, like go live, you know, you should put up both remarketing tags on your website and tracking tags on your website. So pretty much all you need to do, it's actually really easy, but you need a developer, if you don't own it, own your website, to just put up, but you create an account, you go in, you go find the tag, and you put it on all the different pages on your website. And then from there, Facebook's able to parse out and create segmentation. And this is for Google too, of course. You could create segmentation on like what people are actually doing. So if you only wanted to target people who went to your homepage, clicked around for a little bit, put something in the cart, and then haven't come back for a week, and target those people with a campaign, you can. And that's something where you could get like really specific, because you know a lot about that user and you know that they have some brand affinity already. So that's I would be careful about it, just because to a certain degree, the people who are in your remarketing list, some of them are going to convert anyways. And so just because you show an ad to them, it doesn't necessarily mean that that ad was responsible for making that conversion. So it could get a little bit complicated.
So you're saying like, be careful, don't go plow a ton of money into this, because those people are already kind of like warm leads and they might be paying you even if you didn't invest.
Right. Well, so if you ever wanted to do like a remarketing, like the most profitable remarketing segment you could go after is someone who's just hovering their mouse over the buy now button, right? That's like the very warmest of all leads. You probably don't need that ad there. But like, let's say someone visited and then they left and they haven't come back in a while. I think that's like really fair to start pushing again. And different products have different times that it takes for people to actually buy. So like if you have an average product price of like, let's say $250 or so, oftentimes you'll see from first interaction to your website to actual purchase be 30 days. So like during those 30 days, you have a lot of room to advertise to that person and keep it front of mind, things like that. So there's definitely valid remarketing. It definitely drives a lot, but you have to be careful with it, because sometimes they're going to purchase anyways, and you don't want to just be that ghost following them through the internet. So,
well, on that, why not? I mean, you think that if you keep showing up and there's no interaction, there can be a negative effect on the relationship with the customer?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. When remarketing first started getting big, one of the unforeseen consequences were that a lot of Christmas gifts got spoiled, because someone would go on to J.Crew and buy a sweater, and then J.Crew would advertise them that sweater for the rest of their life, and the person who the sweater was bought for would see all these ads. And they're like, wow, that sweater seems right up my alley. So that's like it's kind of funny, unintended part of remarketing. But absolutely. Sometimes you'll be on a website, and through remarketing, you'll see 8 variations of the same ad taking up every ad slot on the website. That's not a very good consumer experience, right? So like there's things you could do to make it a little bit more bearable. You could put frequency caps on. You could have waiting lists before you start remarketing, things like that. You don't want remarketing ads are one of the ads that are most commonly complained about on Facebook, where people say, I see this ad literally every single time I log in. You know what? Come on, guys. That's a bit of a negative experience.
Yeah. You know, I always find it interesting. I mean, this is a whole subject I could go on a tangent about, but when you're remarketing, you always run the danger of your brand showing up somewhere that the context is not right for your brand. So I saw this happening a ton with like all the crisis oriented news that we've had lately. I will see a lot of brands showing up in the middle of a story that I'm reading about, you know, a natural disaster or a political tragedy or whatever it is. And you're like, did you really want to be there? Because that's kind of, I don't know. But I guess we're not at a point yet where brands really can control exactly where they appear, are we?
For Google, there's definitely categories that you can skew your brand to be safer, shown in safer spots. It's just not perfect. I mean, Google is trying to categorize like the entire internet, and it's just too much. But yeah, I get this all the time. The Breitbart effect, where it's like you see your ad showed up maybe once or twice on Breitbart. And usually what it is from people who are being remarketed to, but they go to Breitbart specifically to see what ads are on there and then tweet about it.
God, that's like a dark underbelly of this whole subject area that I hadn't even thought about.
Yeah, it's people specifically trying to call out that, you know, hey, your ad shouldn't be here. And it shouldn't be. But the reason it is because we were marketing to you and you went to the website specifically to look for the ad. So it's kind of a funny little situation.
It is. And I imagine this stuff is only going to get more complicated as time goes on. Well, so we could go on for another 2 hours about this, but to kind of bring the conversation to a close before I go into the questions that I always ask every guest at the end of the podcast, are there things that you think that we didn't touch on that you'd want to call out for people listening just to have in mind as they continue investigating how they're going to work digital marketing into their brand building?
Yeah, well, I would just say, like, just to get yourself acquainted with the channels, like, take advantage of the free stuff. I think a lot of people are just intimidated without really needing to be. And then when you actually start jumping in and building some campaigns, I would say just like look at all the different settings and just make it as conservative as possible, just so you know that there's a lot of easy mistakes to be made, like in terms of, oh, I accidentally targeted the entire world, or, you know, something like that. That's probably not going to give me that much benefit. So, like, I would say just be very careful and go through it. That's how you learn. You got at some point, you have to jump in. And it's going to be a little bit scary, but, you know, that's how you learn.
All right, great. Well, so I have a few questions I always ask every guest at the end of the show. Are you up for answering?
I don't know. I'm scared.
No, you're going to be fine. Okay.
I'm very confident on the advertising front. I don't know how comfortable I feel on the other stuff.
Oh, okay. You're going to be good. Okay. So are there any tech tools, apps, books, resources, or just a great piece of advice that's helped you in your day-to-day life that you think would help our listeners in their day-to-day lives?
Interesting. Okay. So I really have this new system that I've been doing religiously, and I think it's great. What it is just a 25-minute timer that I work for and then a 5-minute break. And
it's just the Pomodoro, right?
Pomodoro. I'm all about it.
Got it. It's cool. I've tried it.
Yeah.
I'm not as disciplined, but you think it's really works for you.
It really does. I think it just really, I feel like so much of what happens for me is like I try to multitask and then I end up like doing half of everything. And the Pomodoro, what I could do is I could just say, this is my 24 minutes for this, do it, and then move on. So that's really great. And do you have any, I have this other tool that I'm right now totally enamored with, but it's for B2B. Would your users care about that too much, Lauren?
Yeah, what is it?
Okay, it's called Lead Feeder. It's super cheap. All it does is you attach it to your Google Analytics. So it will look at the IP addresses of the people who visited you. And if any of those IP addresses were associated to like an office, like a business, it will just identify those businesses and then show their level of engagement. So I have this thing where I'm pushing all this traffic and I'm trying to collect leads, and it's a hard time to know like what's a good lead, what's a bad lead. And if they don't put the information down, I don't know who they are. But what this does is just looks at their IP address and just says, oh, actually, a guy from BCG spent 10 minutes on the website yesterday coming from our ad. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's amazing. You know, I really love it. So I'm recommending that to everyone who has any like B2B. It's like very simple, very cheap. It's effortless to set up and you get to see what businesses visit your site.
So. Cool. Well, thank you for the recommendation. And as listeners know, I will put links to anything recommended on the show in the show notes. So if you're listening and you want to find that, you could obviously Google it, but you can also check out our show notes and you will find links there. So this is a funny question to ask you because I don't think I've ever asked a guy on the show this, but you and I have never hung out. But if
That's
we
not true.
Did, if well, I mean, we've met. So, but like we never hung out all day. So if we were to hang out all day, what do you think I would end up absolutely loving about you and what would drive me insane?
Oh, man, I don't know. My razor sharp wit, will be both what you love and hate. I don't know.
But I would just feel like I would be too jealous. He's too funny. Okay, I'll take it.
I honestly don't know if I have a good answer to that. So you should ask your husband, who knows me a lot better.
Okay, I will. I'll ask him, and maybe I'll weigh in on the intro to the show when I record that and let people know what he had to say, because I'm sure he'll have something to say. You know what? Actually, you're kind of putting yourself in a little bit of a precarious spot, because who knows what he'll come up with.
Yeah, it could be really bad. I'm scared.
Okay, here's another one. See what you can do with this one. If you had to print a phrase or a motto on a t-shirt and wear it for 7 days straight, what would it be?
Right. Well, so I did create t-shirts for my company. And it was a little bit of a flop, to be honest. I don't think I did a very good job, either aesthetically or just like, you know, I think I bought like the wrong sizes, things like that. But technically, I do have, and I way overbought too. So I have like a million of the exact same shirts for my Blackbird PPC brand. I would have to go with that one. It just says Blackbird PPC. And I might even send a couple your way, because I do have a couple.
Send them over. We'll, we'll take a pic. And never have too many t-shirts. So I always close out by asking guests if you have a question you like to ask me. It could be anything silly, serious. I promise they'll give you an honest answer.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the honesty. So you are now living in Virginia and you moved from the Bay Area. Now, was this a positive move, and what do you miss most about San Francisco?
Oh, I love that question. So yes, very positive move. We lived in San Francisco for, I was there for 16 years, and my husband, Brian, who you know through the digital marketing world, was there for almost 17 years. I mean, we loved it. But, you know, honestly, we were looking for a change of pace, and I wanted to be closer to my family who lives in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And now that we've lived back here, I just can't tell you how different it is to just be in a place that is less frenetic and hectic. And I mean, Charlottesville, where we live, is a college town that's got a lot of artsy stuff going on. There's a brewery or a winery like every other foot, and there's artsy stuff going on. There's always live music, and it's really family friendly, and it's just super, super chill, despite what you would think about it from the national news of this year. Yeah. I mean, it's been crazy. That's been a really crazy thing to impact the community here. But in general, living here has just been, it's been great. I mean, this probably won't really make much sense to you because you're 30 and you don't have kids. But like, if you are somebody that has two kids and you're, you know, our age, living in the Bay Area, I mean, I would go places I couldn't even get out of my car because the parking spaces were so tight. And I would be faced with, do I get my baby out of the car by like sliding him or her through this tiny little gap in the door and almost like scratch their face? Or do I just go home and like not go to the doctor's office? I mean, I had all these very stressful experiences, and being here, it's a totally different pace of life. But what I miss is San Francisco. It's like the most amazing city in the world. So there you go.
Well, I mean, I would say like a lot of people have the same issue, you know, like, oh man, housing is so expensive. Parking's a mess. Traffic's terrible. And there's like all these other options, like, you know, Charlottesville or Austin or Seattle, Portland, even San Diego, where you could get a lot of what San Francisco offers, but without the same difficulty to, you know, even buy into the market for the housing.
Yep. And I'm actually really grateful and virtual high five for putting Charlottesville in the same category as Austin and, you know, some of those other cool places. So thank you for that. And thank you for coming onto the show. If people want to find out more about what you do with Blackbird PPC, what's the best way for them to hunt you down and connect online?
Yeah, well, so I think you can either go on LinkedIn. My name is Jay Samphill, or you could just email me at jay@blackbirdppc.com.
All right, awesome. Well,
and I'm happy to take a look at your accounts, talk. I love all this stuff. So.
Oh my God, you're going to open up the floodgates.
Yeah. Come on in.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and have a great rest of your week.
Okay. You too.
Done and done. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Jay. I know I did. I got a kick out of talking to him. I don't know if he's going to be offended, but I'm just going to say it. I don't think I've ever been as happy to have someone come on the show and mansplain to us as I was having him. So Jay, thanks for your time. Thanks for dropping the knowledge, and thanks for the work you do to help Fest Brands. Speaking of Fest Brands, I want to give a huge, huge, huge shout out to Laura Wittig. She's the founder of Kennebecker and also the Brightly Co. And she's a Presto member. She's been a longtime supporter of the Spirit of 608 podcast and also early member of Prestope and the services that we offer. And I have loved getting to know her. And it has been so cool to see the journey that she's been on this past year with trying to grow and build her brand and two brands actually at the same time. One, Kennebecker, is this awesome handbag concept that I just can't get enough of because they, not only is it a cool looking bag, but they have removable liners. And I don't know about you, but I've never heard about anybody doing this in like a cool, stylish way, but it's something I so need. And so I'm excited to see her product come onto the market. And also at the same time, she is growing the Brightly Co. marketplace for showcasing sustainable, ethical, just feel good, do good brands in the fashion accessories space. And she was able to launch Kennebecker this week. I sort of buried the lead there. She, her big news is that after many months of working towards this, Kennebecker is now live for pre-orders. It's very cool. Congratulations, Laura. You've worked really hard. I know you're going to kick ass. All of us at the Spirit of 608 are totally behind you. And speaking of being behind things, I know that sounds a little bit weird, but thank you for listening to this point and being behind the Spirit of 608 podcast and giving a crap about what we talk about and what we do here. So virtual high fives across the, I don't know, these aren't even airwaves anymore. I don't even know what it is. Just like the atmosphere, right? Thank you for listening. If you ever want to help the Spirit of 608 out, totally free, quick thing you can do, subscribe, rate, and share the show with people in your life. Really helps us out, helps us reach more women who are interested and a better fashion industry for all of us. I hope you'll join me next time for another conversation with a woman at the forefront of fashion, entrepreneurship, sustainability, and tech. As you know, I call it fast, and it's the future.